Kevin?
No. It's Iowa.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Hey, thanks for joining me today. We've got 2 hours ahead of us of stimulating conversation and reflection. That's my promise to you on the most important things of life, ethics, values, and religion. It's stimulating in part because you participate. 1-800-227-5278 is the number if you'd like to call in from wherever you are. Unless you're here in Southern California, in the Orange County area code 714, the number direct is 754-4150. And got some good news and some bad news for you. Those numbers, once again, 1-800-227-5278 and in the 714 area code 754-4150. Just a couple of days ago, though, the National Institutes of Health came out with their guidelines in response to the president's directive for human stem cell research, and this is the good news, bad news. All right. Let me just read a relevant paragraph of what the guidelines are that came down as a result of the president's executive order. That executive order canceled all past restrictions and expressed an intent to ease the restrictions and use embryonic stem cells for research, fund that enterprise, and that the NIH was to draft guidelines, and these came down, and here's what they said. These draft guidelines would allow funding for research using human embryonic stem cells that were derived from embryos created by in vitro fertilization, IVF, for reproductive purposes and were no longer needed for that purpose. So the new guidelines say that we're going to start some new stem cell lines, and we're going to fund them. But the new embryonic stem cell lines are going to be derived from embryonic stem cells that come from frozen embryos that are going to die anyway, because though they were first created for reproductive purposes, that is, to be made into children, they will... since they're not wanted by their parents and they're in deep freeze and they're going to die anyway, we'll just use them for some good purpose. Research. It continues, NIH funding for research using human embryonic stem cells derived from other sources, including somatic cell nuclear transfer, that's SCNT, fancy scientific word for cloning. That's how Dolly came about. Remember that sheep? Long gone now, by the way. It was somatic cell nuclear transfer that produced Dolly. Anyway, it says, at this point at least, NIH funding for research using human embryonic stem cells that were derived from sources like cloning or parthenogenesis and or IVF embryos created for research purposes is not allowed under these guidelines. So it says yes and no. We will use human embryos that were created to reproduce a human being, but no other human embryos. None from cloning, and I have to say at this point, because the president has already expressed his desire to build cloning factories to give embryonic stem cell research a boost. But for now, and this is the good news, the only embryos that will be sacrificed for embryonic stem cell research under this present administration are those embryos, those little human beings in the earliest stage of their development that are in deep freeze and will likely be discarded, and so they can be used for research. Now, this is a bit curious. I mentioned there is good news, bad news. The good news is there's a restriction. There's a limitation. And I'm glad for that. Now, it does say in this that the NIH funding of the derivation of stem cells from human embryos is prohibited by annual appropriations ban on funding of... Actually, I should start this over so it's not so confusing. There is a bill that is a funding bill that prohibits the use of federal funds for certain types of research that is the thing that really has restricted the government in the past. And this is a bill that Barack Obama signed, what, 3 days after his presidential, his executive order, saying that he wanted to free up these funds for stem cell research. But the problem is the bill he signs 3 days later nullifies that effort. The bill contains the Dickey Wicker Amendment, which says, in part, quote, none of the funds made available in this act may be used for, one, the creation of human embryo or embryos for research purposes, or two, research in which a human embryo or embryos are destroyed, discarded, or knowingly subjected to risk or injury, close quote. So it seems to me even these NIH guidelines that allow for research on embryos that will be discarded still are not up to snuff with the Dickey Wicker Amendment for the funding bill that controls these kinds of things. Maybe they think it is. I'm looking at the wording here. I don't get it. But let's just say it passes muster with the Dickey Wicker Amendment, and there's details about that in the upcoming Solid Ground, May 1st, 2 weeks. But there's another problem, and this is the bad news. By the way, Washington Post, in an article yesterday, Stem Cell Sense is the title. NIH research guidelines avoid some moral minefields. They write, by limiting federal funding to research on stem cells derived from embryos that were created for reproductive purposes and that were slated for disposal, the National Institute of Health's draft guidelines issued yesterday offer an intelligent solution to an issue that demanded great sensitivity. While a decision with such deep moral and ethical considerations shouldn't have been left to scientists alone, the NIH outcome is a good one. So, high praise from the Washington Post. Here's my question. What is intelligent about this decision? And further, what is sensitive about it? Now, from my position as a person who is concerned about the ethical ramifications of these kinds of decisions and is trying to carefully apply his training and philosophy, of which ethics is a sub-discipline, I am deeply confused by this decision. So let me say a thing about how moral logic works. An action is unethical when it violates a moral rule. All right? So car theft is wrong because it violates a larger principle. It's wrong to steal another's property. Car is someone's property. You take it. That's stealing. Stealing is wrong. So car theft is, pardon me, so car theft is wrong. Now, the same rule has other applications, by the way. In other words, it's wrong to steal another's property doesn't just apply to cars. So the moral principle covering car theft equally covers plagiarism, for example. That is, stealing somebody else's words. So if you object to the first, that is, car theft, but condoned your own plagiarism on term papers, I think it's fair to question your commitment to the broader principle, it's wrong to steal. It seems kind of ad hoc. That is an expression of a mere emotive preferences for the moment. So you're not following the rules, you're doing what it feels right in the moment. So if somebody steals your car, you don't like that, that's wrong. But if you steal somebody else's ideas or words, oh, that's okay. Notice the inconsistency there. It's not good moral thinking. Because the moral rule that applies to one is not allowed to apply equally to the other. When you have consistency, then you have sound moral thinking. When you're jumping back and forth and you've got a rule in one circumstance that you then don't apply in the other circumstance, it starts to sound fishy, like you're playing games, okay? Now, the moral logic pertaining to any preborn human life can be stated very, very simply. And here it is. It's wrong to kill innocent human beings. All right? That's the basic moral principle. I mean, you want to take exception with that, we'll have a different discussion, but it seems pretty straightforward to me. That's wrong. Now, both abortion and embryonic stem cell research kill innocent human beings. Now, if you think about it, if it is wrong to kill innocent human beings and abortion and ESCR do that, then guess what? They're wrong. That is simple logic. I'm putting it as plainly as I possibly can. It's the moral logic of the pro-life view that applies not just to preborn children at later stages of prenatal development, but at the earliest stages as well. The same rule applies. And this is the moral equation that pro-lifers are supposed to affirm. And if we affirm it, of course, then we, in both cases, we are being consistent because we are affirming the underlying moral rule. Pro-choicers, on the other hand, by and large, deny that maybe a bona fide human being is being sacrificed. Again, another issue we deal with in our materials, like Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, or Precious Unborn Human Persons, a booklet that I've written that helps to go through these details. The point I'm simply making is that the way moral logic works is you start with a principle and you got to apply it consistently in both places. Or else you're not really being moral, you're just being convenient. By the way, if you saw Kathy Ireland on Mike Huckabee last week, I think, she did an excellent job in defending the pro-life view. A lot of people noted that what she said on that show, and we also put clips of this, I think, on our Facebook and on our blog last week, so you can go to my Facebook or to our blog and you can see Kathy in action. People say, boy, that sounds like Stand to Reason material. As it turns out, Scott Klusendorf and I trained Kathy about 12 years ago when she was starting to do little stints on Politically Incorrect, and then she was on Hannity and Combs, and now she's on Huckabee's show, and all these years doing a wonderful job promoting the pro-life message in a thoughtful, consistent way. In fact, Huckabee said when he heard what she said, and I'll tell you what it is in just a moment, he said, I've never heard it explained so well by anyone, which is like another good news, bad news. I'm glad Kathy did such a good job. I expect no less from her. But it's just too bad that Mike Huckabee has never heard that kind of defense. And basically, she offered what I offer in Making Abortion Unthinkable and in Precious Unborn Human Persons, and was a foundational principle we taught, Scott and I taught her, 12 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. And that is this: if the unborn is not a human being, no justification for abortion or embryonic stem cell research, for that matter, is even necessary. Why have these discussions if what you are killing is just not another human being? Well, it's just a piece of flesh. Who cares? No further discussion is necessary. However, if the unborn is a human being, then no justification is adequate. Because we do not kill innocent human beings for the reasons that people give for either abortion or embryonic stem cell research. So we take this principle and we apply it to what the NIH guidelines are. So Barack Obama's administration says we're going to go forward on embryonic stem cell research and we're going to make new lines and we're going to take them from embryonic human beings. And that's okay. Because these embryonic human beings were not initially created for research. They were created to make babies. And since they were not created for research, then we can kill them. Somebody make sense out of that for me. How does it follow that if you have an innocent human being in the earliest stages of development that was not created for research, then you can research on them. But if they were created for research, you can't do that. Now, when it comes to cloning, it's exactly the opposite, and I owe this observation to the enforcer. When it comes to cloning, and I talk about this in The Solid Ground, so you need to get this to get the full story, the backstory, all right? They make a distinction between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning. Reproductive cloning is cloning to make a baby. Therapeutic cloning is the kind of cloning you do just to get stuff for therapeutic analysis, experimentation. What is the difference between those types of cloning? Not a dad blasted thing. All cloning is reproductive cloning, because all cloning reproduces a bona fide human being. The only difference is whether you allow that human being to live or not. And ironically, the policy is exactly the opposite in the case of cloning. It's legal to clone as long as you do the cloning. You create an embryo for the purpose of destroying it for research. But it is illegal. It is a big no-no. In fact, with the way the president put it, it is wrong and should not be done by anybody at any time to create an embryo to allow that embryo that was created through cloning to survive and live another day and grow up and be a baby. Oh, that is an awful thing to do. None of that. So here's the logic of the Obama administration. If you have embryos, can you kill them for research? That depends. If you have an embryo created by IVF and it was intended for reproduction, then you can kill them. If the IVF, if the baby created, the embryo created by IVF was intended for research, then you can't kill them. But if instead of using IVF, you clone, then you cannot clone if they're intended for reproduction, but you can clone if you plan to use them for research. Do you realize, ladies and gentlemen, not only is this contradictory, the whole thing is nonsense? If it's not wrong to carve up an innocent human being to use them for scientific testing, then why does it matter where they came from, or why they were originally created? Carve it up. But if it is wrong to carve up an innocent human being to use for therapeutic experiments, then it still doesn't matter where they came from or the purpose for which they were created. It's still wrong. That, by the way, is called moral consistency. And that is something you rarely see in public debates about this issue, at least currently. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason. Your calls in just a moment.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians. And it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Standing to Reason for Classical Christianity and Classical Christian Values. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. 1-800-227-5278. If you want to talk about anything that's on your mind in the broad area of ethics, values, and religions. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Starting May 3rd, our two-hour show will be extended to 3 hours. We are adding another hour at the beginning, not at the end. When I first started radio with the Crawford Network, I started at 3 and went to 6. But in the winter, we lose that hour. So we just decided to add an hour on the front end to our sequence now. And so we'll be going starting May 3rd from 2 until 5. And May 3rd, we're going to kick off that segment with Scott Klusendorf. We'll be talking about his new book dealing with the pro-life issue. But I just want to let you know so you can mark your calendars so that you tune in an hour earlier than you normally would, or else you'll miss Scott and in subsequent shows everything else that goes on here at STR. All right, let's go to the phones, and this is Rick in Santa Ana. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good.
My question today, I called a couple of weeks ago and gave a question on the identification of miracles. I was having a conversation with a skeptic at the time.
Right, I saw the note come up here, and I wondered if you were the same person that we had talked with then.
That's me.
Yeah, that's good. Bring the callers up, or rather the listeners up to speed. In this conversation, as I recall, the skeptic was asking for your definition of a miracle or your requirements in order to know whether a miracle has occurred. And basically you said, and I think this was a wise way to go, you took the particularist route and you say, well, sometimes, you know, it's hard to figure out all the requirements for a miracle, whatever, but sometimes you stumble upon them and you just know them when you see them kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the better place to start. And that was the way you had addressed that particular that challenge.
Correct. He challenged me and said, what are the criteria that you use to identify when a miracle occurs? And, you know, just kind of before we get into it, sooner or later it occurred to me this guy's just being, you know, he's just being silly and rude.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'd like to do is you know, do a follow-up from, and then get from you, you know, I know kind of in my head, yeah, this guy's being silly, but I'd like to see if there's a kind of a pithy way I could put it so that mm-hmm. other readers, or if I have the conversation in the future, other people listening in can see, wow, yeah, the guy's being kind of silly without having to know, you know, all the technical jargon and being, you know, having to follow the whole conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I just basically used a common sense, what I call a common sense approach. You know, look, if a man dies, he's certified dead, and some people pray for him, right after the prayer, he's alive, you know, I don't know. Common sense says to me, that's a miracle. Okay, what can we glean from that example? That's kind of how I, mm-hmm. you know, talking about the particularist approach. And now what he replied, he made two separate replies. The first one was that the way I was going was I was being tautological. I was saying, well, if miracles happen, then miracles are real. And that's not quite what I said, but that was his reply.
Mm-hmm.
Then secondly, and I guess this is the more important objection, he said that, well, your list of characteristics is arbitrary. He said, well, let me read you a quote here. Blah, 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 blah. He said, I'm sorry, no characteristics present themselves to you. You invent them, and then you present them to yourself. And then he says, said a little bit later that my list of criteria has no necessary relationship to the supernatural, the supposed supernatural nature of the event that I made up. And I mean, my basic reply is like, well, you know, I don't know, if I see somebody raised from the dead, I don't think it's arbitrary to say that that's a miracle. It's just common sense.
Well, most people will say that people don't get raised from the dead because those kinds of things are governed by natural law. Mm-hmm. So if you have a person dead at point A, time A, and alive at time B, that would be sometime afterwards, bona fide dead and bona fide alive, in a way that couldn't be explained by natural circumstances, then you have a violation of those natural circumstances, and you have what people call a miracle. So I'm not sure if somebody says... You're asking, by the way, of a kind of maybe a quick way around this. You might ask him does he deny then that miracles happen? See if he takes the bait. Because if
you repeat the point, you cut out for a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. You could ask him is he denying then that miracles happen? Is that his view? Mm-hmm. And then he says, yes. The minute he takes the bait, he's sunk. Because then you're going to ask him another question. And what do you think that question might be?
I don't know if I'd ask a question.
You'd ask him.
Well, it seems to me like you're just dismissing him out of hand before you eat.
No, it's actually a different tactic here. But the question I had in mind was to ask him, what do you mean by miracle? See, what he's doing with you is he's not going to allow you to present any evidence for a bona fide miracle, because he's going to fuss so much about the definition of miracle, he is going to dismiss any possible evidence as simply, arbitrary, okay? Mm-hmm. You don't know what a miracle is, and any criterion for a miracle are going to be simply arbitrary. And so, this doesn't mean anything. This is a meaningless discussion. But the minute that he says that he does not believe that miracles happen, he is in exactly the same situation, because now he's denying the existence of something. What? Miracles. Well, what is the miracle that he denies that happens? Now, he's got to define it. He says, well, I think that there are no violations of natural law. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so that's what your definition of miracle is, a violation of natural law? Yes. Okay, so now he's given you the definition. Well, let me use your definition. If I saw something that was contrary to natural law that happened, then I'd have a miracle, wouldn't I? Mm-hmm. Notice you're using his definition. Of course, you could push him in a silly way, and you could say, well, why would you call a miracle a violation of natural law? You know, why would you use that definition? That sounds like an arbitrary definition. You could play his own game against him, which would be just as silly as him playing against you. But if he even uses the word miracle in an affirmative sense, I mean, he's using it in a meaningful way, not just repeating your use of the word. If he's saying, well, I don't think miracles ever happen. Mm-hmm. What is a miracle that it never happens? You're going to ask him for the definition.
Yeah.
And see,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
And so this is why I think you're – initial intuition about his motives is a good one, because I think he's just simply playing games with you. He is going to try to find some word reason why you are just simply dismissing, why he is justified in just dismissing your claim to miracles without ever considering the thing itself. But the same kind of foolishness works against him in the discussion, you know, if you ask the right questions.
Uh-huh. Now,
by the way, you know, a tautology is simply a definition, like a bachelor's or unmarried males. All right?
Uh-huh.
The tautology itself, definitions, don't introduce any new information. It just repeats it. It doesn't tell you if there are males or unmarried males, or it doesn't tell you whether there are males at all or if any of them are unmarried. It just says if there are males that are unmarried, we're going to call those unmarried males bachelors. All right? The fact that you identify, even if your definition of miracle is tautological, which all definitions, by the way, are tautological, all definitions, a miracle is, miracle equals this. So on the either side of the equal sign, you have an equivalency. That's the whole point of a definition. But you can't go from a definition which is tautological by nature and say, well, then therefore definitions are meaningless, or that the thing that you're defining doesn't exist, or there's no criterion by which you could determine these things. You know, you could say a scalding is when boiling water is poured on somebody's hand and it makes blisters appear. That's called scalding. Okay, I mean, you could say now, is that a tautology? Yes. All definitions are tautologies. That is, the term on one side, scalding, equals the same thing as the sentence on the other side. It's just a repetition, just in other words. But what that's done is given a criterion for understanding when scalding itself happens. So if you see somebody pour water on somebody else's hand and then it bubbles up, it's fair for you to say, according to the definition, that's scalding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that arbitrary? Well, yeah, I guess you wouldn't have to call it scalding. You could call it bippity bop if you want.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the certain sound that we use to describe it is arbitrary. But what we're trying to identify is something significant. So in this case, we are trying to identify, let's just say for a loose definition, a violation of a natural law. Maybe I think definitions of miracles go beyond that, but that certainly might be a working definition we'll work with. So a miracle is a violation of natural law. Oh, that's a tautology. Of course it's a tautology. You asked me for a definition. All definitions are tautological. But it does provide a criterion for knowing when the word miracle applies. I don't know why that would be considered arbitrary, because the word miracle is used by people all the time. And generally in these kinds of discussions, that's the kind of thing they mean.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point about definitions. I actually did, what you were talking about earlier, about asking them, do you think miracles are possible, and kind of pushing him to shoulder his burden of proof. And this is kind of where I figured out he's just being silly. I did ask him that question. I said, do you think miracles are even possible? I'm not asking if you think they've actually happened. I mean, are they possible at all? And he comes back and says, well, you need to think about what possible means. Define your term precisely and then get back to me. And I'm like, well, come on, man.
Yeah.
Play fair.
Yeah, sure.
Every time I pushed him on what he meant, he would come back and give me some question like, hey, you're being ambiguous and you need to precisely define what you mean.
Yeah.
And after a while I said fine, but I just, it was a little frustrating because every time I had to answer a question, it involved this big long explanation, and I'm kind of looking for a quicker way.
Okay. Here's another little, in a sense, trick that can be used in this circumstance to show the foolishness of this. Whenever you have a person that's a Methodist, and here I'm using the word Methodist in the epistemological sense, not the religious sense, that is, he won't affirm anything unless you've given him the method by which you've gotten to that, and he agrees with the method.
Uh-huh.
The way to defeat that kind of foolishness is to turn the game back on him. So when he says, well, you ask, do you think miracles are possible? And he said, well, it depends on the definition of possible. Once you get a clear definition of that, I'll talk to you. And then you say, what do you mean by definition?
Okay. Yeah, I see where you're going.
I mean, so you can play the bit. The thing is, the reason that communication is possible between two human beings is because, who speak the same language, is because there are already some agreed upon set of definitions that are in play that we're working with that we understand. And so when another guy is trying to win an argument by denying obvious meanings of words that make a conversation even possible, that's the time to even challenge his words that he's taking assuming definitions of. And so are you, and taking exception with them, and hopefully he'll see that this is really foolish. So you say, what do you mean by definition? Well, I don't have a clear statement. Well, I don't know what you're talking about then. I'd be glad to talk to you about what it means to be possible, since that's the thing that's hanging you up. But until you give me a set of criterion for an appropriate definition, I cannot fulfill your request. So what are your criterion that satisfies, by which I can give you a good definition of possible? So tell me the criterion for definitions. And if you were to give you them, you could always say, well, those sound like they're arbitrary to me. Where did you get those things?
Mm-hmm. And then the point is not that I think his criterion are arbitrary. It's just that I'm trying to, play his game and talk his language.
Exactly. It's basically a taking the roof off tactic. You say, okay, I'm going to play your game, and I'm just going to show you how foolish this is. The person that's in the way here is not me who can't define possible. The person that's in the way here is you, because you can't define definition.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what we're going to talk about. I'd love to answer your question, but until you come up with a definition of definition and a set of necessary and sufficient kind of criterion for it that seem to make sense and aren't just arbitrary, I don't know how we can continue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're kind of just role-playing that a little bit with him, but you're trying to make a point. And the point is that we probably both know what possible means. We probably have a pretty good idea about what miracle means, because when I said the word initially, you didn't go, huh? I never heard that sound before. What does that sound mean? No, you, of course people have a pretty clear idea of what it means. And when you give and it's entirely appropriate to give an example of a miracle to define it. It's called ostension. You're pointing at it. You say, what's a car? And you say, that's one right over there. You're pointing at it. And here's another one, and here's another one, and here's another one. And our mind is able to generalize all these instances, so you kind of get a sense of what the word card means. That's the way my daughter's learning to talk, my 16-month-old. So, you know, that's standard. That's the ordinary way of doing things. And if he says that's an arbitrary definition, you say, it's not arbitrary, it's what I mean by that. It's what I mean. So here's what I mean. Maybe somebody else might mean something different. Fine. Then they come up with their own definition. But what I mean is like somebody's dead in a grave for 3 days, and then he gets up and walks out. Or, you know, like Jesus, after he'd been wrapped in 100 pounds of spices, 3 days later, he's up and walking around. Or, you know, you have 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and there's enough to feed 5,000 men, plus the women and children. And there's more than you started with when you left. If that actually happened, that's what I mean. I mean that. So it is entirely, and the person says, why would you call that a miracle? They say, because that's the kind of thing that I see that I think it's appropriate to use that term. Now, do you think those kinds of things can happen? That's the issue. See, the issue is about the thing. It isn't about the words.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making it about the words.
Yeah. After a while, he did kind of show his cards. He said, look, if somebody gives me that type of testimony, then, you know, basically they're batty. They're telling you a falsehood, no matter how trustworthy they are, or what the testimony is, no matter if it's, you know, in writing or in court.
So in other words, you believe before you consider any evidence that whatever it is we're talking about, put a big X in that spot, is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you believe that? Why would you think that somebody is batty? So now the shoe is on the other foot. Now you're the one asking the why questions. What are your reasons for considering them batty? What are your definitions of insanity? Why would such a claim be an example of somebody who's a little bit loony?
And at this point, I have no clue why he said this, because I did press him on that. You know, I said, well, you know, you need to justify your worldview to me. In other words, you know, it's a naturalistic viewpoint. You know, I'm like, hey, you got to shoulder your burden of proof. And his reply was really strange. He said, you know what, worldviews aren't exchangeable like you're assuming they are. You're a materialist just like I am. And you know, that's when I kind of said, all right.
Yeah, that didn't make a lot of sense either. I'd have more questions for him. But this will have to do this time, Rick. Got to run, okay? Yeah, thank you for the call. And going to break, be back in just a moment with more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has 3 essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all 3 of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel. I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Hochul will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Greg Hochul, Stand to Reason. And I just realized that in that long conversation with Rick, I was actually talking to Rich. I just misread the enforcer's handwriting. And then I found out it was a Rich that I know and been in my home and been a longtime friend of Stand to Reason. So thank you for the call, Rich. And I apologize for not for messing up your name and not realizing who I was talking to. Good to see you, by the way, at the debate a couple weeks ago. Sorry we didn't get a chance to talk. All right, let's get back to the phones here. We've got about 10 minutes yet in this segment. So let's go to Moore Park, which is right around the corner from where I'm at in Thousand Oaks, and this is Tim. Hi, Tim.
I love you, Greg. Did Satan outlaw Ventura County churches and marriage because of two Bible verses? I don't know the numbers of them, but it's in the last one is in the last days people will worship the creation and not the creator, and the number two, in the last days, doctrines of demons will outlaw marriage and eating of certain foods.
Well, both of those textual quotes that you gave me are actually misquotes. They come from different passages. I don't know, and I'll tell you what they are in just a moment, but I don't know anything that's going on in Ventura County that has to do, which is where I live too, and you do at Moore Park, has to do with outlawing church and marriage.
Well, I believe in the last 2 weeks, the county of Ventura voted to outlaw people meeting outside of city limits because they want to save open space.
Well, how can the city outlaw meeting outside of the city limits?
No, the county. Did I say
the county?
City?
You might have. I'm not sure.
Ventura County.
Okay.
In the last 2 weeks, Ventura County voted to make it illegal for people to meet outside in spaces zoned as open space, which is anything outside of the city limits of any city in Ventura County, and which makes it illegal to build a church or to have a marriage outside of the city limits of any of the cities in Ventura County, which is in the county part of the county.
Well, this is the first I've heard about this, and I don't suspect this is going to actually have that result. It's hard to tell. Sometimes, and this happens a lot with these more liberal enterprises, that is, they have some noble goal, preserve the open spaces, and there's a lot of open space in Ventura County, which is one of the reasons it's nice to live out there if you're in the Los Angeles area, but they don't understand the broader ramifications. I don't think this is about stopping weddings or stopping churches. I think this is about preserving space. But and then what happens is later on they realize, well, there's some problems with this ordinance. I really can't speak to the details of the ordinance. I don't know. So I don't know what their plan is with that.
I believe here's what I believe. I believe that some of the people in the government, not all of them, are actually witches, but they don't want to say they're witches because you won't vote for them. So what they say is that they're environmentalists, and what they actually want to do is outlaw churches, but they don't want to say, look, we want to outlaw churches because we're witches. So they say, look, we want to save the environment, so what we're going to do is we're going to make it illegal to build churches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't know if that's what's going on here. I guess I'll just have to have a wait and see. But that if that's their goal, it's not going to survive because there are too many church-owing people here that are voters, and that includes people in government. So I don't think that's going to survive. I know there have been problems with churches with zoning regulations in the past, and there have been legal battles because the Second Amendment allows you to meet peaceably in a group. And so they can't restrict your religious freedom to assemble in that way. So we'll
the
see about
Amendment.
That. What did I say? The second?
You said the second. The Second Amendment is your right to own a gun.
I meant the second clause of the First Amendment.
First Amendment.
All right, it's right there in the the front end.
Right.
It's one of the biggies there. Anyway, the first verse that you referenced actually comes from Romans chapter 1.
Okay.
And it doesn't say in the last days they will do this, that they will suppress the truth and unrighteousness. It says that man has been doing that from the beginning.
Okay.
That this is the case of man under God's creation, no matter where he's at, no matter what kind of special revelation he's been given. He knows enough about God to honor God properly, but instead of doing so, he suppresses the truth with unrighteous motives. And worships the creature rather than the creator. The second passage, where you talk about forgiving, or rather prohibiting marriage or giving a marriage. I'm just paging through my New Testament here, my older one, which is all falling apart. So I've got these pages falling out on me here. I think it is in 2 Timothy chapter 3. Nope, I don't see it.
It's at the end of the Bible next to Revelation, I think.
Oh, well, it could be in 1 John, or I mean 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, right in there somewhere. But in any event, it seems like the Scripture's term in the last days, it's referring to what we now call the church age. So for the last 2,000 years, we've been in the last days in that sense. But there is a warning against asceticism in the New Testament, people who forbid marriage and the sensual enjoyment that comes with it. They promote abstaining from certain foods and everything as if this is going to be the thing that's going to make you spiritual, and of course that's not the case at all. So that's probably what it's talking about. Tim, got to run here. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Cindy in Houston. Cindy, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, my question is, the movement that you're a part of, the movement to bring the intellectual life back to the evangelical movement, does it have a name?
I saw the question up there, and I've been thinking about it. Well, first of all, it doesn't have a name that I know of. There is actually a movement, a kind of a movement called The Movement, but it's a very recent development, and it's really an attempt to self-consciously move forward with worldview instruction for not only our young people but others as well. And there was the first meeting of The Movement in the last week of January of this year. Chuck Colson and friends kind of initiated that, but it really wasn't, I guess it was kind of to start a movement, but it was really not so much to start a movement but to take something that was already in play and to be a little more self-conscious about moving it forward. And they just simply called it The Movement. But what you're describing is really much more expansive than what they were doing there, because they were talking about worldview organizations that are training consciously with worldview issues. And Stand to Reason, of course, does that, Summit Ministries. And in fact, there's a whole host of people that were there, leaders of organizations. There were 125 people there, and we got invited, and I was glad to be there. Craig Hazen was there for Biola, and a whole bunch of other folks, too. Brett Kunkel was invited. He was part of that. But that's the only movement that has a name that I know of, and it's just simply called The Movement. And that was just kind of applied to that meeting for lack of another name. It's kind of like D-Day. And people say, what does D-Day mean? It just means the day that of the invasion, and nobody knew where it was, so they called it D-Day, and it was happening on H hour, It was just a placeholder. And the same thing is true with The Movement that happened in January in Washington, D.C. So there are a whole lot of people that are committed to the development of the mind in the pursuit of Christianity. We call it a Stand to Reason, Clear Thinking Christianity, or Christianity Worth Thinking About. There are a whole host of other organizations that are part of this. But like, I think, any genuine, real, and long-term productive movement, these are grassroots roots enterprises that just, they start from, people responding to needs and the Holy Spirit moving that. So I actually never even thought of what to call what we do. Thoughtful Christianity is another way I characterize it. But I guess the simple answer to your question is the movement has no name.
Okay, well, thank you. It would make it a lot easier to share with people, you know, what I'm interested in.
Well, why don't you just use it descriptively and say, I'm interested in thoughtful Christianity.
Okay.
That's the simplest way to put it. It means that you are committed to classical Christianity. Maybe that's another word you could add in there, to kind of a mere Christianity, to use C.S. Lewis's language. You're committed to a classical mere Christianity. And even though you might have more sectarian convictions, the thing that you're promoting is non-sectarian. It's broadly based classical Christianity. And you're trying to do it in a thoughtful, reflective way. You are in the mainstream of Christian thinkers for the last 2,000 years who believe that Christianity was worth thinking about and that the smart money was on Jesus and God. And the God is characterized in the Bible. And, you know, those are just some different descriptive ways that you could put it, I think, that might help clarify for others what you're about. And then just expand in your own words. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. Well, thank you, Greg.
Okay, you're welcome. You're welcome for the answer, and thank you for the call from Houston. We've used all kinds of different terms over the years. And I've mentioned most of them here. Clear Thinking Christianity is the way I started out in 1990 when I started broadcasting for Crawford. But since then, it's taken on different little handles, as it were. Christianity Worth Thinking About is what you find on our little Stand to Reason sticker you can put in your car, your books, or something like that. But I'm kind of glad it doesn't have a name as a movement officially. But as people recognize what's going on, that's the thing that matters most. All right, we have another hour ahead of us. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you're in the 714 area, code 754-4150. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And that was a stimulating first hour. I enjoyed it. I look forward to our second hour together. In about 3 weeks, we'll be starting a three-hour show. We'll be starting an hour early on May 3rd. So be sure and tune in. What, in 2 weeks? 2 weeks from today? My bad. In 2 weeks, we'll be starting a three-hour show, starting at 2. Too many twos and threes in this discussion. Get mixed up. I mentioned earlier that Kathy Ireland had been on Mike Huckabee's show and had made a wonderful, brilliant case for the unborn. As a pro-life the pro-life advocate that she is, Mike Huckabee was very impressed with what she had to say. I had to take a little pride in that. We at Stand to Reason did, because we trained Kathy a number of years ago, and we're glad, though we haven't been in touch recently, we're glad that she's continuing to carry the torch and to do so well. But it was Mike Huckabee's comment that, in response, that was the good news, bad news comment that you know, got my attention. On the one hand, good news, that was the best, clearest characterization of the pro-life view I've ever heard, something along that line. And I wondered why he'd never heard it like that before. And apparently he's never heard of Stand to Reason or our material. Now, that's not surprising. Lots of people haven't heard it, so it's not to his discredit. But it shows how tragic it is that major Christian leaders who are deeply committed to the pro-life cause don't have visibility of the best training material around for the pro-life view. And that would be Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion. Or that's a training tool, or simply our booklet called Precious Unborn Human Persons, which you can get from Stand to Reason. When I say it's the best training material around, in some ways it's easy to say this, not just because I think it's really good, and I do, but unfortunately there's just not that much training material around. So the competition isn't very heavy. Which reminds me, in 2 weeks, Scott Klusendorf, who helped me develop that material, will be here. We'll be interviewing him on The Case for Life. That will be the 3rd of May in the first hour from 2 to 3. The reason I'm bringing this up right now at the beginning of the show, and I'm going right to your calls in just a second, is because we would like to get our material in Mike Huckabee's hands. Because he's the kind of guy that can make that material and those kinds of arguments better known around the country. And if he is a political force to be reckoned with, and some think so, then he needs to understand the moral logic of the pro-life view and be able to articulate it at least as well as Kathy Ireland. We can help with that. We just don't know how to get him the material. I guess we can just send it to his address. But if any of you have any kind of an inside track on Mike Huckabee, if he was impressed, and he was, with Kathy Ireland, he might be interested in where that information came from. And he may be interested in doing another interview with the authors of that information for the benefit of his people so that they can get that information too and learn how to properly defend the pro-life view. Understand the moral logic of the pro-life view, be able to respond not only to the question of abortion, but all of these issues like embryonic stem cell research, which trades on the same moral logic. So I'm just tossing that out to you. If you want to help us out with that, be glad to oblige you if you can somehow make a connection with us and our material. Actually, we should flood Huckabee with that stuff. Have about 10 of you send it to him from all different states. Say, Mike, you got to see this. If you like what Kathy did, you got to see this stuff. All right, back to the phones. And Paul in Houston, I'm glad you called, Paul. Hi.
Oh, hey, Greg. It's actually interesting you just talked about that. I'm the guy who sent you that Facebook message on Saturday night right after I watched the show.
Oh, did you? So you were the one who drew it to our attention then, huh?
Yeah. I don't want to take the credit. I don't know if anybody else did, but I sent you that Facebook message saying, hey, I just saw Kathy Ireland do this, and then...
Well, Paul, you're the guy. So Melinda okay. just gave me the heads up on that, and she said, yeah, you're the guy. Some others might have seen it, but I think you're the first one to draw our attention to it. And I'm actually not watching a whole lot of TV lately, especially lately, or reading much news or anything. I'm trying to keep a good attitude about life. So, but when those things happen and you give us a heads up on it, that we follow up on it, and we're glad to do that. Thrilled with Kathy's presentation, and thanks for alerting us. And many other people you saw on the Facebook followed that link. Really enjoyed what Kathy had to say.
Yeah, it was really good. And just after on Huckabee's website, I actually posted that on the forum. He has a forum for people who can talk about the latest show. Mm-hmm. I posted that. Look, she got this from Stand to Reason, so I posted links to y'all's website and everything.
Oh, that's great.
The forum there.
So. No, we haven't heard from him yet, so
yeah.
We'll keep working. But you can pray about that. I mean, I one of the things that we struggle with, Paul, is that we think we're doing some important things and glad to have an impact in some other people who have wider audiences than we do, like Kathy. But, you know, Frank Beckwith said a number of years ago that Stand to Reason is one of the best-kept secrets.
It is.
And we would love to change that. And if we can have some time with Mike Huckabee, at least on this issue, or because I know that his show is a little on the political side, so some of the other stuff we do may not be as significant, but this would fit his show. I'd be glad to glad to party with him on that one.
Yeah. By the way, just to put a face to a name, I was the guy. I came up to you after the Hitchens debate, and I put that book in your hand, Family Driven Faith.
Right. Okay, good. Okay. I've been going through that. So, and you also gave the Christmas star.
Oh, the star thing, yes.
Yeah, that was great. So thanks for the overall impact you're having with SDR.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to chime in a little bit on the guy who was talking about the miracles there. I just wanted to give my two cents in. Norman Geisler has an excellent book called When Skeptics Ask, and he has a great chapter over the question about miracles,
and
he gives a good definition. Also, I've heard Bill Craig give a good definition one time. He said that miracles are basically an event that lies beyond the productive capacity of nature. So I thought that was a pretty good, quick definition. I've heard him speak.
Sure, that's one of those elegant philosophical kind of things you'd expect out of Bill Craig, you know, beyond the productive what?
Beyond the an event that lies beyond the productive capacity of nature.
Huh. Now, I talked with Frank Beckwith once. He did his PhD work on miracles and the David Hume's argument against miracles. Uh-huh. And Frank pointed out that sometimes there is no actual violation of any...
I was going to mention that. I was going to just read a couple of lines from this book that actually kind of talk about that.
All right. This is Geisler's work, right?
Yeah.
I do have the book When Skeptics Ask, so I should check this one out when I go home.
Yeah, it's really good. And in fact, he says the first step in this, as in all the discussions, is to come to a clear understanding as to the meaning of the term employed. Argumentation about whether miracles are possible, and if possible, credible, is mere beating the air until the arguers have agreed what they mean by the word miracle. And then he says, a miracle is divine intervention into or interruption of the regular course of the world that produces a purposeful but unusual event that would not have occurred otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
He says, but a miracle occurs as an unusual, irregular, and a specific act of God who is beyond the universe. And he says, this does not mean that miracles are violations of natural law or even opposed to them.
Uh-huh.
And then later on in the chapter, he says, he talks about the nature of natural law. He says, you know, but today scientists understand that natural laws don't tell us what must happen, but only describe what usually does happen.
That's true.
Their statistical probability is not unchangeable facts, so we can't rule out the possibility of miracles by definition.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting, you know, that all of that he said is useful and helpful, especially this last observation, and a lot of people don't really quite understand this, but strictly speaking here, the enterprise of science moves forward based on the inductive method, not the deductive method, but the inductive method. They just look at regularities based on lots of examples, okay, and then they draw generalizations based on these examples. What they don't do is bear witness to what might be called occult or hidden. I don't mean like demonic, but I mean just simply hidden forces.
Right.
So, like causal forces, you know, this is a little bit, you know, outside of the realm of science, strictly characterized here. So, what they do is they just identify these regularities. Now, of course, you know, the scientists they talk about these laws, but the laws aren't things, you know, that allegedly cause things to happen. They are just, again, statistical characterizations of what actually has happened.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we could split hairs about that a little bit, but I think there's an observation there that he's making that is a fair one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
However, with regards to the earlier definition, there were some things I might just pick a bone about, and only because I'm thinking about Riches, the earlier caller's discussion with the skeptic, he would have a heyday with that definition because there's so many particulars in there.
Mm-hmm.
One of them that I think would be troublesome is when Norm Geisler starts out by calling it a divine intervention.
Mm-hmm.
A miracle is a divine intervention. Now, it seems to me whether or not a miracle is a divine intervention is some subsequent step of reasoning that one makes.
Mm-hmm.
Because on that definition, the devil couldn't do any miracles. I mean, look at Moses. In the case of Moses, didn't you have Moses that you know, has the staff turns to a snake, and then you have the Egyptians do the same thing. So that's if one is a miracle, the other is a miracle. But I don't think that we are committed to saying that the Egyptian magicians didn't do a miracle, or if they did, then it must be God.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can have this kind of, you know, intervention of sorts, this suspension of what appears to – this irregularity of the natural scheme of things, however you want to characterize it, without saying God did it. I think it's when people see the miracle, then they conclude from the nature of the miracle and one that was doing it, that it was God that was doing it on his behalf.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree, yeah.
So I wouldn't use the divine thing as a definition, as part of the definition, personally.
Okay.
But that's just me. I just think that it's going to make somebody vulnerable to the same kind of problem that Rich had with the skeptic he was discussing, which wasn't an intellectually honest one, I suspect. But, Paul, thanks for all your help.
Yeah. I love you all there. Stand to reason. You all rock.
Okay. Thank you. And I appreciate all the, you know, the help that you've been giving us, sending us books and, you know, some of these key things that come up, like the Star of Bethlehem, which, by the way, for the record, I liked very much, and we'll probably be talking about it next time it's seasonal. All right. Let's go to La Habra. That's here in Southern California. Is it Dane or Dave?
Dave.
Dave, welcome to the show.
As far as abortion and a child being worthless, I think the courts are going to turn this around for us. My family member went to a major university. Him and his wife tried to get pregnant, and they wound up selling the eggs and the sperm. And
wait, the sperm and eggs separately, or
oh,
the?
Yeah.
Okay.
And FBI came into my family member's home, told both of them that they had kids. Okay, now. The lawsuit.
Wait. Hold on. Just so I understand here, I just have some clarification questions.
Okay, it's my brother
and
his wife.
Oh no, you don't have to say that. Okay. That wasn't it. I'm taking your story as, you know, I'm taking it straightforward from you as accurate for the sake of discussion here. But I just want to make clear. So what they did is the father donated sperm,
trying to get pregnant,
and the mother donated her eggs in an act of in vitro fertilization. Is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. So then they were participating in their own in vitro fertilization.
Right.
And so the consequence of that were embryos.
Well, I guess they could have been or sold separately. I'm not sure.
Well, did you say that your did you say it was your brother? Or your,
yes.
Okay, well, your brother and sister-in-law, they donated, in a sense, separately, sperm and eggs.
Right.
Okay, so then this kind of just went into the system or whatever, and subsequently the sperm and egg...
No, they were not to go into the system. It was strictly for them.
All right. So then in what sense is it a donation?
No, it's not a donation.
They just gave it because they were trying to have children.
No, they paid a lot of money to try to have the treatment done, and it wound up the doctor was selling it all over the place. The FBI came in.
Oh, okay, now it makes a little bit more sense.
Okay.
So they had privately secured a doctor to do in vitro fertilization to make children for them.
By a major university.
Right, and what happened is the children that were conceived were then sold on the market.
No, the eggs were sold on the market, and I guess the FBI came in and told my brother he has two kids, and that's not the eggs.
Okay.
I don't know what was going on. Okay, but here's the point. Okay, and the lawsuit against this major university is not what... Okay, 50% of it is what happened. And the other 50% is the children you might have had. And this is a very important point. The children you might have had.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, so this is kind of like if you get an injury, it's the income you might have received in the future that you won't receive now because of your injury. So that becomes a factor in this civil suit.
Okay.
Is it the same kind of thing, right?
And later they got pregnant. So... Everything was fine, and the doctor lied to him. Okay, and so now they're, okay, it's just the children that might have been. So all these abortions, I think the possibility of the children that might have been in lawsuits in the future are possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still a little confused on the details here, but that it sounds like to me like what you said was your brother and sister-in-law gave eggs and sperm to make children for themselves, and some of those were used to make children for other people or to at least sell the eggs or the sperm against their knowledge.
Right.
And they produced babies at least with the sperm, so your father your brother had a paternal interest in those children that were produced. Is that right?
Well, no. After about 7 years, they actually got pregnant. Okay, after all this happened, this has been going on for 15 years.
So he's been donating sperm for 15 years?
No. Oh. One or two-time shot.
Okay.
And
so, but what you're thinking is the upshot here is that this is going to have legal ramifications down the line because part of the legal issue was the children you might have had but didn't have.
Well, this is what's going to settle here any day.
Uh-huh.
And or it'll go to trial. And if it goes to trial, you'll hear about it all over the news. It's a major university right down here in the L.A. Basin.
Hmm. Oh, well, we'll try to figure out what that is or keep our eyes on
the
news.
Okay, you see, Irvine.
I was joking, but okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look at Dave. Dave, thank you for the information, and we'll just see how that works out here in the next couple of weeks or months, or maybe we'll get some news of that. Let's go to North Carolina. Oh, we got to go to break? All right, we will go to break. Incidentally, actually, a bunch of lines are open right now. 1-800-227-5278. If you've tried to get in and haven't been able to, now's your chance. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians. And it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Clear Thinking Christianity, ladies and gentlemen, that's what you get at Stand to Reason every Sunday, 3 until 5, and starting in 2 weeks, 2 until 5. Adding a new hour because of popular demand, so glad to do that. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. Getting back to your calls in just a second. I've written a book on tactics in defending the faith. Actually, it's subtitled A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. And one of the tactics there is called Rhodes Scholar. It's one that I've used a lot in the past. And I don't think I've written that much about it or talked about it, but I've employed it. And I found a great example of this on the at primetimejesus.com. This is where all of the smart guys on our side who are doing studies in the historical Jesus, where they kind of weigh in with different bits of information. Engaging the Public Square About Jesus is the subtitle of primejesus.com, and Craig Blomberg is one of the posters there, that is one who posts, and I have one of his posts from his blog in front of me. This is actually a bit old. I think this is actually from last summer, but the point still is valid. And I learned something I didn't know, and that is that there is you know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, those have been around for a long time. Now they got the Dead Sea Stone. It's apparently a stone that was found in the vicinity that has some important inscriptions on it. And this has created a bit of a stir because it seems to suggest that inscriptions on the stone seem to suggest that there was an understanding prior to the resurrection of Jesus that there would be a resurrected Messiah. Now, part of the defense for the resurrection accounts, which include the changed lives of the apostles, is that we believe that their word about the resurrection, for one, because they had no expectation of a resurrection, it's not the kind of thing that they would make up. Now, if it turns out that the Dead Sea Stone indicates that there was an expectation of a resurrection, or at least might have been by some people, then that, at least in minds of some people, might undermine the force of this argument. To me, from my perspective, it does almost nothing to it. But there's been a lot of talk about it. So, in other words, even if the Dead Sea Stone did record something about a dying and rising Messiah, I don't think that would be relevant to the case for the resurrection of Christ. But let's just say, let's just humor them and kind of go along with this for the time being. Some of the publication about what's on the stone has been pretty aggressive. And in fact, one of the experts who have reconstructed, pardon me, the writing on this stone, reconstructed the phrase to read, "In 3 days you shall live," which Craig Blomberg points out is an eerie parallel to the Christian account of Jesus' resurrection on the third day of his entombment, and that he deduced that the phrase was addressed by Gabriel to a prince of peace who was slain by an evil king. So allegedly, and this is the way the news items in some cases characterized it, because of this expert's work, the stone revealed that there would be a resurrection after 3 days after death by a prince of peace who was slain by an evil king. Well, that's pretty heavy stuff. I mean, that sounds like our story. And, gee, there was written before our story. So maybe our story was just stolen from their story. That's the way some people would argue. The principle of Rhodes Scholar is applied when the Rhodes Scholar tactic is applied when somebody makes the claim of a scholar, scholars have said, and then inveighs against some Christian point of view with a scholarly pronouncement. Scholar said Jesus never rose from the dead, for example. And here you have scholars say that there's this inscription that says, you know, 3 days after the death, one would rise, a prince of princesses. Did I say prince of peace? Prince of princesses is what I meant, who was slain by an evil king. You say, well, the question you ask then, and this is the tactic, is why does he believe that? The idea is not just to look at what the scholar believes, but to get back to his reasoning. Let's get back to the reasoning. What is it? Rhodes Scholar. This is also another example of just the facts, man, where you kind of get back to the facts of the deal and show what the facts are and see if they actually support the notion. Well, in this particular case, Craig Blomberg puts the translation there for you to read. Here's what's actually in the text. And I'm going to say space every time there's a what scholars call lacuna. Lacuna is like a hole or something missing. And sometimes there's a question mark here, which I'll cite, because they're not sure that the word that has just been translated is the right translation. So here's what Craig Blomberg shows is the actual evidence that these scholars are drawing from. You, I'm quoting now, you, question mark, will save them. That is, I'm quoting from the translation of the Dead Sea Stone. You, question mark, will save them, big space, from before you, the three signs, question mark, comma, three, big space, in 3 days, space, I, Gabriel, space, the Prince of Princes, space, Harrow Holes, question mark, big space, two or four, big space, and the space, to me, question mark, out of the three, the small one, whom, question mark, I took, I, Gabriel, Yahweh of hosts, the Lord, question mark, of Israel, space, space, big space, then you will stand, space, space, space. Close quote. Now you're thinking, why did Kokel read that to me? That hurt my ears. Because it makes the point that Craig Blomberg makes in his blog, which he says, does anybody else see this rising, dying, 3 day rising prince of princesses killed by the evil king in that? That's much more than reconstruction and deduction. That's plain just making things up and adding them in. Or am I missing something? Blomberg writes. You know, you read the news stories and you think, oh my gosh, they got something on us. Then you get somebody like Craig Blomberg who says, well, let me just, you know, give you the facts, ma'am. And then you read the facts and you say, okay. They are putting a lot of imagination in this translation for the Dead Sea Stone. So I appreciate guys like Blomberg who are out there doing the job for us. And it just goes to show a lot of times, even the scholars are making a lot of it up. The first person to plead his case seems just until another comes and examines him. All right. All right, let's go back to the phones. And still room here, 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code. The number is dialing direct, 754-4150. This is Cynthia. Hello, Cynthia, North Carolina.
Hi, how are you? Appreciate taking my call.
I love that. How are you? Isn't that sweet? That just, oh, I like that. You're welcome, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Well, I have a comment, plus I have a question also.
Okay.
I don't consider myself the most educated person in the world. I did attend a college, and I graduated with a bachelor degree.
Mm-hmm.
And all through my school years, I learned, you were talking about facts, that when you take, especially in science, a male part of a plant or animal and unite it with a female part of a plant or animal, whatever you have, whether it's an oak tree, weed, or whatever, those two parts, the union of those two parts, are going to create whatever the parents were, right?
Yes, they create a new thing that is the same kind of thing
the
as that which created them.
Thing.
Yes,
exactly.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's what I learned. So this is my question. I'm confused about the fact that when a man and a woman unite, their union doesn't create a human that they like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the opposition of pro-life,
mm-hmm,
are claiming, that this unborn child is not a child. It's not a human.
Not a human. Well,
it's a thing. It's a blob. So if you could clarify for that for me, I would appreciate it.
All right, Cynthia, you are not confused. They are.
No, I understand that, but how can we convince them that they're the ones that are confused?
Well, there's a couple of things, and I go into very careful detail on this. It's not cumbersome, but it's careful, in the booklet that I wrote called Precious Unborn Human Persons. You know, it's very accessible. It's a standard reason booklet. It's available, at our website, str.org. And I ask a couple of simple questions, and then I kind of talk about this a little bit. And so if I were having a conversation with someone, it might go something like this. This thing that's in question, this thing that's growing inside mom, all right,
mm-hmm.
that you want to take out, you want to abort, is that thing alive? And the answer is going to be yes. We know it's alive because it's growing. If it's growing, it's alive, all right? That's the problem, and that's why they want to deal with something. So it is growing. Now, the question is it mom or is it something else? Well, we know it's not mom. And if this was unclear to anyone in the past, since the advent of the plethora of crime scene investigator, CSI movies or TV shows, everybody knows now about DNA analysis. And they know that that thing that is growing inside of mom can't be part of mom in the strict sense, that it isn't mom's body, because the DNA in the thing doesn't match the DNA in the mom. Right? You with me? What happened? Cynthia, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe you're breaking out a little bit. Okay, so this is what I'd explain to him. So we know it's not the same as mom. It's something else. What is it? Now, and this is where I'd go back to this other. We got something individual that is growing inside of mom. It's growing inside of her uterus. It grows in the place that all things that are a result of a sperm and an egg coming together grow.
Exactly.
It is reproduction. So the thing that is reproduced is a separate living thing that is the same kind of thing that mom is, but isn't mom. So mom and dad have reproduced another human living human being that is growing inside her womb. Now, that's embryology, and that's as straightforward and as simple as it gets. That kind of thing is a human being. It isn't just a human cell. It isn't a mere human cell or a batch of cells. It starts out as a batch of cells, but in this case, the batch of cells is the human being itself. I mean, somebody might say, well, that's just a clump of cells. And my response is, so are you.
Exactly, in the beginning.
Well, even now, you're just a bigger clump of cells. But you're more than just a clump of cells. You're a separate individual human being. And the one growing inside of mom is a separate individual human being, too, with its own nature, with its own, genetic fingerprint. And it's got a human genetic signature. So we know this is it's simple science, what you've said here,
exactly.
Cynthia. It's simple science that it's that which is growing there is an unborn human being that is the offspring of the parents that produced it in the way that in the place growing in exactly the place it's supposed to be. So this shouldn't be surprising. I think that people who are fair-minded are going to see that and acknowledge it. But many people who are pro-abortion are pro-abortion. They are not simply pro-choice. They are not fair-minded about this. And this is why their language is littered with all kinds of deceptive and misleading comments instead of sticking to the issue, the single issue that matters, and that is, what is it? If the unborn is a human being, no justification for abortion is adequate. If it's not, no justification is necessary. It's just as simple as that. And that's what Kathy Ireland told Mike Huckabee. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you got it right, Cynthia. You're not confused. Everybody else seems to be, though. Many others.
Why is that such? I don't understand why it's such an issue. A dog has puppies growing within her.
Yeah. That's right.
They're born, they're puppies.
Yes, like dogs have puppies, fish have guppies, people have yuppies, you know?
But
pretty straightforward.
Exactly. So it's just...
Something else is going on here, Cynthia, than just kind of the straightforward thinking on it. People have deep emotional, irrational emotional commitments to certain views. And because they're emotionally committed to them, or prejudicially committed to them, they are going to stick by those views even when sound moral thinking and good science point in another direction. These are not people you're probably going to be able to win. What I want to win is the mushy middle, people who can be influenced, who just are, you know, uneducated, who have never heard this kind of explanation before, and can have their own intuitions about life in the womb bolstered and strengthened by some good facts and good moral reasoning. All right, Cynthia?
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, and appreciate your call, too. How are we doing time-wise? Do we? I guess we got to keep going. Okay, let's go to Frank in Indiana, and let me get your button there, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. It's Frank Beckwith calling.
Oh, Frank, of course. Golly. I probably would have recognized your voice if you gave me a little bit of time here. But so Melinda says it's Indiana and 90.7 FM, so that's probably what you're listening to, I suspect. And Indiana would be that would be Notre Dame University where you're at right now.
Well, I'm actually driving toward I'm driving south towards Indianapolis. I'm speaking at Wabash College tomorrow, actually on the issue of abortion.
Uh-huh.
And I heard your program. I actually was, you know, looking at the clock, and I thought, you know, Greg's on right now somewhere in America. Maybe he's on here. So I went to AM, you know, went over many times, and I thought, well, maybe he's on FM. And sure enough, you popped up.
I am so glad to hear that. Well, that's funny, Frank. I'm glad you're listening, and I know you do, and you podcast, you listen to the podcast, and I hear from you on occasion, and appreciate your encouragement. And is Frankie with you at the moment?
No, she's actually back in Texas, and actually I've got about 3 more weeks here at Notre Dame. And
gosh, the year is up already, isn't it?
Yeah.
My goodness. Well, you had this kind of a year away from your kind of your home school there in Texas and Baylor, and got to do this work at Notre Dame. Good for you. I'm glad it. I'm glad you had that time, Frank.
Well, you know, I wanted to, if you don't mind, I wanted to say something about the Rhodes Scholar tactic. That's why I called. I thought your illustration was terrific.
Thanks.
And I don't know if you've seen this or maybe some of your listeners have. Stanley Fish of, I think, I don't know where he's teaching now. He used to be at Duke University.
Yeah, he's the kind of postmodern philosopher of sorts. Civil, law and society and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, he just published a piece about this whole question about the conscience clause for healthcare providers that don't want to perform abortions or refer patients, and
which is under challenge with this administration, as I understand it.
Absolutely, and he was defending getting rid of the conscience clause on the grounds that the medical profession is a profession, and if the profession says you should perform it, you should perform it.
Hmm.
And this is a case where the confusion between what counts as expertise and what counts as a moral judgment. The question is, are physicians the right sorts of people to assess the morality of abortion?
That's a great question, Frank.
And it's a great Rhodes Scholar one, because a lot of times people think that if you are dealing in an area, that means everything that occurs in that area is within your expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like saying that the question of capital punishment is one that can only be assessed by electrical engineers because people are electrified in electric chairs.
I remember when I wrote the chapter on Rhodes Scholar for the Tactics book, and you have a copy of that, right? We sent you a copy. I know we did. Yeah.
I've read portions of it, and I plan to read the whole. Right now I've got a bunch of books I'm reading, and it's I do want to read it and actually maybe write a review on my blog.
That would be great. Well, I've got some funny lines from you that are in the book, but I gave you due credit for it, so you get cited there. But in the book, though, I do mention whatever the proposition was on the West Coast that allowed for funding of embryonic stem cell research here a couple of years ago, and how they promoted the proposition with all these Nobel laureates. And this is an example of what you're talking about. Just because the person knows a lot about science doesn't mean that he knows whether it's a good idea to carve up human embryos to use for science. It's a different question.
Exactly. There's a just yesterday, I guess it was a Episcopal priest who is also a lesbian. It's actually not shocking, is it? And who
surprised me?
She's the dean of Episcopal Seminary in New Haven, if I'm not mistaken. And she...
also not surprising.
Yeah, and she made the statement that... she said, very similar to Fish's argument, said, look, if you're a doctor and you're pro-life, then get out of medicine.
Mm.
You don't belong there. And it occurred to me that here's a theologian in a denomination where there's no such thing as heresy.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently within medicine there's such a thing
yeah,
as heresy.
Yeah, that's a great observation.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, I just hope that, you know, it's almost like truth is stranger than fiction, and you just think it can't get any sillier, and it does. Especially, say, like somebody like Fish, because I know you've written about him in the past. I've read
yeah.
some things you've written, and it just seems to me a lot of his issue has to do with liberty and the law. And it
yeah.
almost strikes me that he should come down on the other side of this question, and
yeah.
and he just drinks the Kool-Aid without even thinking about it.
Well, I think with him, I mean, one of the great influences on his work is the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who basically argued that there are no rights outside of a state or a community.
Right.
And so for him...
He's a social contract kind of guy.
That's right. So in a way, it actually does fit his view in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he appeals to Hobbes in this article. Now, one could argue that the conscience clause, if it remains, is actually part of a larger community and not inconsistent with Hobbes.
That's right.
Right? I mean, so I think you can use Hobbes either way.
Yeah, and this isn't going to bode well for the lesbian either, because for
yeah.
a long time, you know, the culture had implicit, at least, prohibitions to homosexuality. And if you take the Hobbesian social contract approach, then there is no morality outside of the culture. And, of course, you and I wrote on this in our book on relativism.
Yeah.
Then this means you got a moral obligation to obey the culture, and homosexuality is immoral by definition. And, by the way, so would same-sex marriage, even in the present climate. Because
that's
the
right.
rank and file, on balance, do not approve of it.
See, I think at the end of the day, Greg, that the emotivists ultimately won. What I mean by the emotivists, for those, it's a school of thought in moral philosophy. It says that all our moral judgments are really comes from our sort of visceral
mm-hmm.
likes and dislikes, and there's a lot of folks in at least secular philosophy think they're really rational.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the end of the day, they're really emotivists.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of this is just a rationalization of what they already viscerally believe.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens, you can tell that too, and I talked at the beginning of the first hour, which I think you missed, but you'll probably catch
yeah.
on blog, but
yeah.
I mean on podcast, and I talked about the NIH guidelines for embryonic stem cell research, and I thought, well, this is good because there are some restrictions, but it makes no moral sense.
That's
it's
right.
completely ad hoc because any consistent moral guideline would either prohibit all use of fetuses for embryonic stem cell research or allow any use of fetuses, even those created for the purpose of research, and if you know, for embryonic stem cell research. But this half and half business is it's completely ad hoc. It makes no moral sense whatsoever.
Well, there's a reason why it doesn't make moral sense. Funny you should mention that. I was actually at Princeton yesterday at a conference with Robbie George when his iPhone or BlackBerry got a message about the president's new or the NIH's new policy, and Robbie came up to me. For those who don't know, Robbie George was on the President Bush's bioethics commission.
Right, and we've had him on the show. We've had him on the show before, and of course he's one of the main folks that weigh in on this if he's allowed to, does so brilliantly.
Well, it was great. He comes up to me and he says, Frank, did you read this? And I go, well, actually, I just got it on my iPod. And he said, you know what? He says, I'm happy about this, but, he says, it fits the polling data to a T.
Mm, mm.
And he says, it's very Clintonian.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, basically what the Obama administration did is they read the polling data and they realized...
Yeah.
that this was the path of least resistance, and you're right. That's why it's morally incoherent.
Yeah, let me offer you an observation that Melinda Penner, the enforcer, offered on our way in today to the studio, and this I thought was brilliant. Now, you know that the Obama administration, or you probably saw the EO, the executive order on March 13th or whatever it was, when he kind of canceled out the past EOs on limitations to stem cell research and then kind of put his own opinion forward and opened the doors for new things. But he said he's keeping the door closed on reproductive cloning. There is no reproductive cloning, okay? Now, you and I know this is just a sleight of hand because all cloning is reproductive cloning. It's just that when it comes to cloning, you can clone a human being as long as your purpose is for research. Then you can kill them. But if your purpose is for reproduction, you can't do that. Now, in the NIH guidelines, you set the cloning principles aside there for a moment. Now, on the NIH guidelines, it's exactly the opposite. If you create an embryo for reproductive purposes through IVF, then you can use them for embryonic stem cell research. But if you create it for research, you are not allowed to. It's polar opposite.
That's quite an insight. I'm going to have to read that. That's great, Melinda. I know you're listening.
She's listening. She's grinning from ear to ear. She loves it.
That's great.
Tell Robert George that one too, because it is a profound insight, and it just underscores the lunacy of the moral thinking of this position.
Well, you had Doug Kamek, the Pepperdine professor, who's a supporter of Obama, say that. Defend this whole reproductive cloning, non-reproductive cloning distinction. And so Robbie had a debate with him in U.S. News and World Report, and I sent him a question to ask Kamek. I said, ask him what he would, supposing there was a case where there were three embryos that were brought into existence with somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is cloning.
Right.
All three were planted in a womb, but two were taken out. How many, and the third, the first one that was remained came to fruition, that is, it was born. How many clones did you produce? Three.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, so the reproductive part of it is, in fact, the fact that it isn't going to be born doesn't mean it's not a clone.
Of course. It's
and that's correct. I mean,
I've written on this in the Solid Ground that just come out that all cloning is reproductive cloning because all cloning reproduces a human being.
Yeah.
The only difference is the unfortunate fate of the human being so reproduced.
They are
free to call it therapeutic cloning as long as they, assassinate that young human being, sacrifice that nascent human being, before 14 days or whatever it happens to be, before it becomes. And this was, I know you're equally troubled by Ron Reagan's comments at the DNC election cycle before the last one, where he said, as he described this whole process, he says, no fetuses are destroyed. Well, that's because they don't live it long. They don't allow the embryo to live long enough to be qualified for the name fetus.
That's the thing
itself is destroyed, and so here
like
you
saying,
have this.
It's like saying no teenagers were killed in this abortion.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, let me ask you another question. A little, just a skosh off topic here. Are you going to Notre Dame's graduation?
No, I'm not, actually. I'm going to Baylor's graduation.
Okay, well, of course, this is a freighted question because of the nature of this graduation. You want to tell people about it?
Well, Barack Obama was invited to give a commencement address as well as to receive an honorary doctorate of laws. And because Notre Dame's a Catholic university, that, unlike some other Catholic schools that have sort of lost their identity, and some other ones that are much more conservative, Notre Dame is sort of right in the middle. That is, there's a fight for its identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, the school claims to be pro-life, and I have no doubt the president is pro-life, but it has drawn a lot of attention. This honorary doctorate, as well as the commencement address, has drawn attention because of not only is Barack Obama pro-choice, he's also radically pro-abortion.
Robert George did a fine job in his piece a few months ago to make this really clear that this pro-choice doesn't apply to this man. Pro-abortion is the word that applies to him.
That's right, especially with wanting to lift the conscience clause. It really goes ironically against Roe v. Wade, because there's that one portion of Roe where it says, when doctors and theologians and philosophers disagree when life begins, the court is not going to make a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the court can't make a judgment, clearly the legislature can't make a judgment,
mm-hmm.
and neither could the executive branch.
Right.
So by requiring the doctors perform abortions, ironically,
they're going against Roe v. Wade, which says that the question's up for grabs.
Right, right. Well, it's, you know, for a guy who confesses to the nation that questions about the beginning of life were above his pay grade, he sure is making a lot of decisions about that now.
Well,
I don't know.
I think he's getting money under the table.
Oh, gosh. Frank, I got to go to a final caller here before the show is over. It's just a thrill to have you call today, and all the best to you and Frankie, okay?
Well, you as well, and keep up the good work, brother.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Frank Beckwith calling from the road somewhere between West Lafayette, Indiana, and Indianapolis. Okay, let's go to Bob in Riverside, California. You made it, Bob.
Hey, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Sorry, we're a little tight on time here. What's on your mind?
I'm actually picking up a comment you had made a little while ago in reference to how people experience heaven in different degrees. I guess based on how, you know, their... What, at the point, how soon in their life they accept Christ or perhaps...
Something like that. Hold on just a minute. Let's go for another 2 minutes on this one, okay, because I want to give a little bit more time. My comment was it has to do with a couple of different passages that seem to imply that though everyone who is a Christian, who is forgiven, let me put it that way, it's better, I think, everyone who is forgiven of their crimes against God are welcome into his community forever, it doesn't mean that everyone is going to be having the same experience with heaven. They're not all having the same resurrection. Some obtain a better resurrection than others. And this seems to be tied to what happens in our spiritual formation and development here in this life. Now, the idea of better resurrection comes from Hebrews 11. Towards the end, you'll see this language there. Some who did not receive relief from their suffering, but were endured by faith through their suffering so that they would obtain a better resurrection. We also see in Timothy, I think it's in 1 Timothy, where Paul tells Timothy that physical exercise, it gives little profit, but godliness is a means of great gain, for it gives a promise, it holds a promise, not only for this life, but also for the life to come. So it seems that what we develop here in our spirituality has ramifications for the quality of our existence when we're in heaven. Now, I don't mean to suggest that some of us are going to be disappointed. I think we're going to realize that we have attained to exactly what we developed in this life.
Would it be sort of like your capacity to appreciate heaven is greater?
Capacity for something, I'm not exactly sure what follows there, but I think the capacities are going to be different. Of enjoyment, of fulfillment, of satisfaction, of closeness to God, something like that. And I don't want to push that too far because I don't have those details. However, one person put it this way. I think somebody else thought of this illustration. It's like each of us is going to be a perfect light bulb at a fixed wattage. So some of us may be a perfect 100-watt light. Others are going to be a perfect billion-watt light, you know. We're going to shine brighter. We're going to be perfectly at our stage of development, but there are going to be different stages of development. And I realize that this is a little bit incomprehensible to some people. And I was first introduced to the notion, I think, by J.P. Moreland, and it intrigued me, the whole idea of developing virtue on this side of the grave, because it made a difference in eternity. He said that God is in the business of developing a people that are fit to spend eternity with him. And that's what this life is about. And it puts our trials and tribulations and difficulties in an entirely different light when we think of it that way. By the way, I mentioned Hebrews. My wife and I just read Hebrews 12 just the other night. And there, the writer of Hebrews says, it is for discipline that you endure so that we might share in his holiness. And the discipline doesn't seem fun in the moment, but afterwards yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So these are all verses that seem to suggest that there's something going on in this life that gives us something in the next life. So those people who don't become Christians until their deathbed, they may get into heaven, you know, but they're doing so naked and smelling of smoke, as it were, you know, because they're not bringing anything with them. They are entering eternity as spiritual babies, and for all I know, they will always be spiritual babies.
It seems to me. I mean, that just makes sense to me. What was that second one you said, Timothy 1?
It's I think it's 1 Timothy chapter 3, the last verse of the chapter. I'm not exactly sure, but it talks about bodily discipline versus godliness and says that godliness has the longer-term benefit. Let's put it like that. Thanks for the call. Bob, I'm glad you made it in. We could end on that good note. I'm Greg Kokel here. Your homework for this week, featured article at str.org, The Zeitgeist Movie and Other Myth Claims About Jesus. Why should we consider some stories as myths yet think Jesus of Nazareth story is actually history? I talk about that there, so go to str.org. I'll be back next week. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ and give him heaven, all right? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.